Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. This week, we stretched the geographical bounds of the podcast a little bit, and I spoke to Congresswoman Donna Edwards, a Democrat who represents Maryland's 4th District. Up until April, the Congresswoman was engaged in one of the country's most closely watched and competitive primary races, as she and Congressman Chris Van Hollen vied for the Senate seat that would be left open by Senator Barbara Mikulski's retirement. A close race until the final days, Congresswoman Edwards ultimately lost April's primary to Van Hollen, which in an online article, Edwards called a case of a black woman hitting the glass ceiling with a concussion-worthy crash. In a race in which both candidates had similar voting records, I asked Edwards more about that claim and about the fact that many people feel the race came down to experience level. I also asked her about an attack ad against Van Hollen that received pushback from Democratic leaders and the White House, which was run by a super PAC called Working for Us, and to what extent she thought it negatively impacted her campaign. We also talked about mentorship, being Maryland's first black congresswoman, and how the state is poised to have an all-male congressional delegation. Unsurprisingly, Congresswoman Edwards is very busy, but we were able to speak for about 30 minutes over the phone. Here's our conversation. I would like to go back to the beginning, if that's okay. When did you know that you wanted to get into politics? Was there anyone or any event in particular that inspired you to follow that path when you were young?
Well, I know that when I was very young, I always paid attention to politics. I mean, even, you know, when I think I was in fifth grade, I was paying attention to politics. And at our dinner table, we always discussed the politics of the day. So it doesn't feel like there was ever a moment, but that it's always been part of how I think about the world.
What was your childhood like? And beyond the dinner table, was your family involved in politics or social activism of any kind?
Not at all. In fact, my father was a career United States Air Force. He spent almost 30 years in the Air Force. And as a child, I grew up moving from one installation to the next installation. And I think part of what spurred them is both my mom and dad were really avid readers. We would always have to actually come to the dinner table with something to talk about that was going on in the world in the day. And so they always encouraged us to be interested, concerned, and active in our communities. My mother volunteered in lots of different things that were not political at all, but it's where I learned how to be a volunteer. And then when I decided that I wanted to work on my first political campaign, I was about 15 years old, and my mom and dad were really excited and enthusiastic, and they pushed me out and said, go do it.
Was there anyone that you looked to that made a career in politics seem possible to you? And how important do you think visibility is, whether it's women in politics, people of color, or women of color?
Well, I mean, I know I was very inspired by people like Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Jordan. I looked at them and said, wow, there are women who, you know, look like me, and they're doing it. And so they inspired me a lot. I paid a lot of attention to Shirley Chisholm's run for the presidency. I thought that was amazing, and I thought she had so much courage. And I paid a lot of attention to Barbara Jordan and her really, you know, sort of powerful presence during the Watergate hearings. I watched almost every minute of it. And I think that seeing those women let me know, even if I wasn't thinking about running for political office then, that there were possibilities. And most importantly, you know, particularly seeing Barbara Jordan inspired me to become a lawyer.
So was running for office always your plan, or how did you arrive at that decision?
Not at all. In fact, I was out in my community, very active in my community in Maryland, in a suburb outside of Washington, D.C. I was, you know, going to the zoning and planning hearings and organizing, you know, folks around development issues in our community. And it was actually through that I then decided that I wanted to run for elective office. And, of course, The first office I chose, unlike a lot of women, the first office I chose was to run for the House of Representatives.
And can you tell me a little bit about that election and that time in your life?
Yeah, I mean, what was really great for me anyway and worked for me is that I had been mostly raising my son pretty much on my own. My son's dad was involved in his life, but I was the organizer and the orchestrator, and so I was driving to, you know, ball games and, you know, school events and really, you know, just invested in my career so that I could be also be a really good mom. And then did this sort of politics work, if you will, local politics on the side. And then when my son was ready to graduate high school, I then thought about the idea of running for Congress. And I explored that because I was very disappointed in the guy who was representing us. He had been an incumbent at that time, a seven-term incumbent, so he'd been in 14 years. And I just didn't think he was doing a great job and that I could do a better job of it. And so I talked to several people in the community. I went around and started to meet people and decided to launch a campaign. And really, at first, I was looking for somebody else to run against him, somebody who already held elective office. But everybody was afraid. They didn't think they could take on the party machine. And so they demurred. And I said, well, somebody's got to do it. And so I decided to become a candidate and run against this, you know, established incumbent, entrenched incumbent. And then I did. That was in 2006. By that time, my son was about ready to go off to college, which was perfect timing for me because, you know, once you free up your time from driving around a teenager, you can take on 735,000 constituents. and so I ran, and I lost that race. I mean, it was I got in, you know, pretty late in the game, didn't raise a lot of money, but came within about 2 percentage points of defeating this entrenched incumbent. And so it was from that experience, actually having lost a really brutal campaign, that I decided that I would run again. And the second time was a charm because I won.
And you became Maryland's first Black congresswoman.
That is exactly right. Can you believe that in a state that is that is the home to Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, that I'm the first African-American woman to represent Maryland in the House of Representatives? We actually haven't had that many women, but we've had a few, but I'm the first Black woman.
What kind of impact did that historic sense of the job have on you? Do you think being a first in that way influenced how you thought about the job or people's perception of your election?
Well, I have to tell you, while I was running and in the course of the campaign, it didn't even occur to me. In fact, it wasn't until really after I won and people started saying that, and I said, that can't be true. I didn't even believe it. I sent some intern or other to, you know, do some research because I thought, how could that be true? And it turns out it was. And I think that a lot of, you know, when I go around to schools and see, you know, young girls in schools and classrooms and Girl Scouts, you know, and all of their activities, and they know. And sometimes they will even tell me about the research. You're the first Black woman to, you know, represent Maryland in Congress, and they feel very proud about that. But also I think that they think about their prospects a little bit differently.
Your identity was certainly central to the Senate race in the spring. I was hoping to talk more about that. What has the past year been like for you? And now that you're a few months away from the race, is there anything you'd like to say or any insights some distance has given you?
Well, it was very interesting because for me, who I am as a Black woman is really important to me. It shapes the way I think about the world, just as anybody's experiences and their backgrounds shape the way that they think about the world, their worldview. It's why we need more reflective democracy that really reflects our population, our gender, our race, our ethnicity. And my experience, though, during the Senate campaign was that discussing that was very complicated, and sadly so. And so when I look back on it, I think that we haven't really quite arrived in a world where all of us are able to talk about the fullness and the wholeness of who we are and still run for and win elective office. And so that was a little bit of a challenge. And, you know, as I think back on it, I mean, this has been kind of a whirlwind year, you know, engulfed in a pretty, you know, brutal campaign, and this one was brutal too, in so many ways, and now coming out of that and looking back on my time in the House of Representatives, which I have enjoyed so tremendously representing our district and representing our state, and now I'm ready to move to whatever that next chapter is. And so even in losing, I think that I learned a lot. I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about the electorate, and I'm looking forward to going on to that next chapter. Don't know what it is yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
You, of course, were running for Barbara Mikulski's seat, who was the longest-serving female senator, and now Maryland is poised to have two male senators. What do you think it would mean for the state to have Mikulski's seat likely filled by a man, and do you think there will be a difference without a woman in that seat?
Well, it isn't even just that seat. You know, not only is Maryland poised to lose, you know, longstanding Senator Mikulski on her retirement, but also I've been the only woman in our House delegation, and we are likely to have an all-male delegation in the House and the Senate come January 2017. And, you know, I don't want to take anything away from the people who are currently serving, and I think that Chris Van Hollen, who beat me in the primary election, is going to be a fine senator and represent Maryland really well, along with Senator Cardin. But I do think that Marylanders and our country lose out on something when we, you know, have 51% of the population that's not reflected in our congressional delegation. When we have, you know, a population of, you know, 14% African Americans in this country, and yet only, you know, half of that number serve in the Congress of the United States. And so, not to take anything away from those who are leading and will lead, but I think that we need to really think long and hard about what it means not to have representation that is fully reflective of the wholeness and the diversity that we are.
Women's issues have certainly been central to much of your work, and seeing as this podcast is called Female Trouble, I was hoping you could tell me about some of that work and also your work with domestic violence.
Well, you know, my work with domestic violence goes way back from my time volunteering in, you know, women's shelters and then working on public policy. I founded a group called the National Network to End Domestic Violence, which is the premier and largest domestic violence program and coalition in the country, and I'm very proud of that work. We worked really hard with women across the country to help pass the Violence Against Women Act that was signed into law in 1994 and is still on the books. But there's still also a lot of work to do. And, you know, not just about having, making sure that women are safe in their homes and in communities, but the security of knowing that we're able to, you know, go to work and, you know, work for decent wages and take care of ourselves and our families. And so the work of women, I think, is the work of families, and it makes men whole. You know, it really troubles me that today, in 2016, women still only make 80 cents on the dollar. And I think that we should all be concerned about that, because when women don't make equal pay to their male counterparts, that takes away from our retirement security, our ability to contribute to our families. And, you know, so that's been central to the work that I've been doing in the Congress, and I hope it's going to continue as part of my work. But that security also extends to things like, you know, making sure that college and higher education is affordable for our families, because when women get an education and when women succeed, I do believe that the entire nation succeeds. And it's the reason that when I was in Congress, I was proud to be the chair of the Democratic Women in the House of Representatives, and we launched the Women Succeed, America Succeeds agenda focused on equal pay and expanding opportunities for child care and strengthening wages in the workplace And all of these things, again, contribute to our growth as a country. And while it may inure to the benefit of one particular woman or other or group of women, it really strengthens our entire nation when women are living to their fullest capacity.
In an article that appeared on Cosmopolitan.com, you described your Senate loss as a, quote, concussion-worthy crash of a black woman hitting a glass ceiling. While I think many people would agree women, and especially women of color, do experience that glass ceiling and face barriers in politics that many white men don't, the counterpoint to that argument was that many people said you and Chris Van Hollen were very similar on the issues, and it just came down to experience level. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I have a couple of responses. Number one, I think that, you know, here's a question. We have 100 senators. There are 20 women, so that's 20% of the United States Senate are women. There's one woman of color in the United States Senate, so that's 1% of the United States Senate that are women of color. We, as women, we represent 51% of the population. There are 42,000 elective offices all across the country, and women only hold about 4% of those elective offices all across the country. And so, again, this is not about taking away from, you know, one man or his ability to lead and represent us, you know, fairly and ably, but it is to say that our country loses out on something when women's voices are not fully heard at the table. And if you break that down to African American women, we represent 7% of the nation's population and less than 4% of the United States Congress. And so we have a lot of work to do, and that is work that is all of our responsibility. And so when you compared, you know, our records, people would say to me, well, you and Mr. Van Hollen have very, very similar voting records. True. They would say, you know, Mr. Van Hollen has served in leadership. I also served in leadership with Nancy Pelosi. So, you know, we have a little bit of balance. But the question is not that. It is, how are we going to actively make certain that we have a democracy that is reflective of the fullness and the diversity of who we are? And I wasn't able to make that case in this Senate race, but we should not put it off the table as a case that needs to be made in Maryland and across the country.
How can we work to get more women and women of color involved in politics? I know that part of the problem is certainly the failure of, as our editorial board wrote, the failure of political parties to cultivate and help finance qualified candidates. So how can we do that?
Well, I think that's true. I think if you go back to the numbers that I talked about, 42,000 elective offices all across the country, those are local, federal, and state offices. And until the people who have power release the reins of power, then we're not going to achieve that because, by and large, men go out and recruit men. Well, where do they recruit them from? They recruit them from people who already hold elective office. And so if you extend that that dynamic to the United States House of Representatives, if Maryland is accustomed to moving people who are in the House of Representatives into the United States Senate, now we have an all-male delegation in the House of Representatives. When will we move a woman into the United States Senate? And so I think that it's incumbent on all of us, for our women and for our girls, for girls to know that they have the prospect of, you know, achieving, you know, at the highest levels of power. And it's all of our work to do. And I look at this presidential election, and I'm so proud of Hillary Clinton and, you know, launching, you know, a campaign that is transformative, absolutely transformative. But we can't stop at the presidency any more than we could stop at the presidency with Barack Obama and say that just because he became the first African-American to be the president, then our work is done. No, our work has only just begun.
Have you had female mentors throughout your political career, or has that been a challenge to kind of find those people within the system to pull you up alongside them?
Well, I think it has been a challenge, but let me just say, I came into the House of Representatives, and I was sworn in by the first woman Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. I can't even think of a better mentor, but we need many more. And frankly, I could have served in Congress or any other elective office at any other time in my life too, but people have to extend the hand. And that's why I was proud during my campaign, for example, to have the support of Emily's List, because, you know, part of the challenge for women running, and particularly for women of color to run for office, is money. Because it costs a lot, unfortunately, it costs a lot of money to run for any elective office. And, you know, as women of color, we may not always have, you know, the networks out there that can enable us to get the resources to run. And that is certainly true for women across the board, no matter where she finds herself. And so I really believe in organizations like Emily's List that go out and, you know, try to cultivate the resources that are needed for candidates so that they can achieve that magic point of viability to run for elective office. And I think that we have to start reaching in some different places and spaces for women who come into elective office. We need to reach in. There are so many women who are, you know, running and growing small businesses. Well, those would be, you know, great skills to bring into elective office. And women who have skills in other areas, in the nonprofit sector, for example. I came out of the nonprofit sector. Great skills for elective office. But if we only go to the tried and true people who already hold elective office, we will be recruiting men forever and a day.
In hindsight, is there anything you would have done differently with your campaign?
Oh, my goodness. There are always things in the, you know, aftermath of a campaign that you would do differently. But here's what I wouldn't do differently. I wouldn't run away from who I am because I think that is important when it comes to public policy, that we have people of diverse backgrounds and experience to solve some of these complex issues. And I would want to be able to talk about those things. I don't rule out a future run for elective office because it has been a tremendous honor to be able to serve in the big ways and in the small ways. We still have an awful lot of work to do. It's not done.
To what extent, if at all, do you think the Working for Us gun control ad negatively impacted the election for you?
Well, I think it had a tremendous negative impact, obviously, and it's not something that I had any control over. It was an independent expenditure. I didn't know that it was coming out, and certainly didn't develop the ad. You don't get redos. When it comes to elections, you run with the hand that you're dealt, and so I feel proud about the campaign that I ran and that I did have control over, and you know, can't really script what other people did.
What do you think has been the defining experience of your career so far?
Wow, that's a really tough question. I mean, I think that, you know, long before I came into Congress, I had a lot of success, as I said, running and founding the National Network to End Domestic Violence. I am very proud of that work. But I'm also proud that in the Congress that I worked with our women leaders to, you know, launch a real national discussion about equal pay for equal work and access to child care and higher wages. I'm also proud of the work that I did on a very local level. I mean, I happened to just run into a woman who came up to me today who said, "I just want to thank you very much because you helped to make sure that my daughter could get a transfer in her military post because I got sick." I didn't know her from anyone, and so we have stories like that, you know, all across this district and, you know, around our state where, you know, members of Congress serve and other elected leaders serve in a way that's not always under the microscope but makes a huge difference. And so I'm proud of all of that work. And, you know, I'm really excited. I'm getting ready to host my 8th annual college fair, which we launched 8 years ago, every single year bringing hundreds of colleges and universities and post high school programs to the 4th Congressional District in Maryland to expose some young people to a possible experience after they get out of high school that they might not ever have had an opportunity to take advantage of. And we get to do that on October 15th, and it'll be my last one, but I'm really excited to have been able to do those kind of things in service to my constituents in the 4th Congressional District. I loved my job. I really did, and I'm going to miss it, but I also know that there are many, many opportunities to serve, and not all of them are in elective office.
Do you have any indication of what's next for you?
The only plan that I have, Quinn, is that I'm going to get in an RV in about late January, and I'm going to spend a couple of months driving all across the country so that I can camp out and visit all of the 48 national parks in the lower 48 contiguous states. That is my plan, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, I hope you enjoy the RV trip. Congresswoman Edwards, thanks so much for speaking.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Female Trouble. As always, you can subscribe and rate us on iTunes or find us wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find episodes at BaltimoreSun.com/FemaleTrouble and SoundCloud.com/FemaleTrouble. We're on Twitter at FMLTrouble, and feel free to tweet us suggestions if there's a woman you'd like to see featured on the podcast. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring TT the Artist. See you next week.